Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez resoundingly defeated a referendum aimed at recalling him from office this past week. But will that change U.S. media's consistent portrayal of Chavez as an unpopular dictator? We'll hear from Venezuela watcher Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Also on the show, broadcasters and cable companies are fighting over what should be done with the airwaves or spectrum freed up by the changeover to digital technology. Who's missing from the discussion? Well, everybody else. We'll talk with Jonathan Rintels of the Center for Creative Voices in Media about the closed-door meetings deciding the future of your TV. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Throughout the war in Iraq, journalists have been greatly restricted by a U.S. military clearly bent on having control over the news coming out of the war zone. A larger number of unembedded journalists have been killed by U.S. forces, and these incidents have been explained by the Pentagon as accidents that resulted from journalists putting themselves in a risky situation, a tacit warning against practicing independent journalism in Iraq. And now, with the siege of the Imam Ali Mosque in Najaf, the warnings are no longer tacit. U.S.-backed Iraqi police have explicitly ordered international reporters covering the Battle of Najaf to leave, and those that stayed on the scene in a hotel on the outskirts of Najaf were threatened by an Iraqi police lieutenant. According to an August 17th report in the newspaper, The Australian, quote, "We are going to open fire on this hotel. I'm going to smash it all, kill you all, and I'm going to put four snipers to target anybody who goes out of the hotel. You have brought it upon yourselves," close quote. After the initial demand that journalists vacate the area, a sniper opened fire on their hotel. It was almost certainly an Iraqi policeman, according to an August 16th report in the London Telegraph. The Australian reported that a reporter from the Arab television network Al Arabiya was taken away at gunpoint. There's been no further word on what happened to him.
Critics have begun weighing in on what you might call the mea culpa kindas coming out of the big papers on their pre-war Iraq reporting. The latest installment was an August 12th piece by the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, which acknowledged that what articles the Post ran challenging claims of the Bush administration tended to be buried inside the paper. But some, primarily online critics, have been highlighting a number of scarily revealing comments included in Kurtz's piece. As when Post executive editor Len Downey explained why they wouldn't place an article questioning Colin Powell's discredited information about Iraq's purchase of aluminum tubes on page A1. Quote, "To pull one of those out on the front page would be making a statement on our own. Aha, he's wrong about the aluminum tubes," close quote. So to question an official's misstatements would be making a statement and is therefore not permitted. Post reporter Thomas Ricks suggested that the attitude was that reporting didn't really matter anyway. Quote, "There was an attitude among editors, look, we're going to war. Why do we even worry about all this contrary stuff?" Close quote. Downey expanded on this idea of journalism as powerless, saying that people critical of coverage, quote, "have the mistaken impression that somehow if media's coverage had been different, there wouldn't have been a war," close quote. Downey claims that such critics think, quote, "media should have crusaded against the war," close quote. Actually, what critics wanted and continue to want, in fact, is that reporters do more than simply parrot official pronouncements, that they investigate independently and point out when the official line doesn't fit with available facts. Most people wouldn't call that crusading, just journalism.
And more along the same lines, New York Times reporter Judith Miller was the latest journalist subpoenaed in the Valerie Plame case, in which the undercover CIA agent's identity was leaked to reporters after her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, challenged a White House claim about Iraq's nuclear capabilities. In an August 13th Times article on the subpoena, Times publisher Pinch Salzberger complained, quote, "Journalists should not have to face the prospect of imprisonment for doing nothing more than aggressively seeking to report on the government's actions," close quote. It's a curious defense of Miller, who penned most of the Times' notoriously credulous accounts of Bush administration WMD claims leading up to and during the war. Miller herself has described her role more accurately. In a February 3rd interview on Boston's WBUR radio, she explained, quote, "My job was not to collect information and analyze it independently as an intelligence agency. My job was to tell readers of the New York Times, as best as I could figure out, what people inside the governments were saying to one another." Close quote.
Right-wing columnist Michelle Malkin has a new book out. It defends the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II and connects that historical episode to what she sees as justified post-9/11 racial profiling. So it was a little surprising to see Malkin lose her cool over a CBS News reporter who cited her book in a recent question to George W. Bush. In the course of asking a question about post-9/11 racial profiling, CBS's Joy Chen summed up Malkin's book thusly, quote, "We have a new book out today that suggests perhaps we should reconsider internment camps," close quote. Though Chen's description of Malkin's book is apparently accurate, the book's title is In Defense of Internment, and it features a picture of 9/11 terrorist Muhammad Atta on its cover, Malkin sent a letter accusing the CBS reporter of a cheap shot and denying that she favors internment in the present situation. Except Malkin didn't send the letter to CBS News's Joy Chen, but to Julie Chen, who is a host, among other things, of CBS's reality show Big Brother. Malkin's inability to sort out CBS employees, which suggests she may be doing a little racial profiling of her own, is the least of her factual problems. Historians and critics say Malkin's book is riddled with historical inaccuracies.
And finally, becoming an official corporate sponsor of the Olympics isn't cheap. The main sponsors of this year's games paid more than $2.2 billion for exclusive privileges, including the use of the Olympics logo, according to one account in the Akron Beacon Journal. In exchange, these companies want not just control of what gets promoted at the Olympics, but what gets consumed as well. It seems that major sponsors like Coca-Cola have declared that attendees can be kicked out of arenas for bringing in food, drink, or clothing not made by the sponsors. The rules, some of the harshest ever at sporting events, mean that fans could get in trouble not just for carrying, heaven forbid, a Pepsi, but even for carrying a brand of bottled water not made by Coke. You can't use any credit card other than Visa to buy tickets, and if you're wearing sports clothing with a logo other than that of Adidas, you could be asked to turn it inside out. The companies claim the aim is to prevent ambush marketing, the nightmare scenario of a non-sponsoring company sending in a block of 100 people, say, wearing their T-shirt and sucking up unpaid-for promotion. There have been a number of comments about low attendance at this year's Olympics. The thinking is that it's due to concerns about terrorism, but maybe people just prefer to watch the games on TV where they can eat, drink, and wear what they please.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
In the last couple of years, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and his government have survived a coup, a massive oil industry strike aimed at political destabilization, the ire of the Bush White House, and, not least, unrelenting hostility from Venezuela's commercial media establishment. And let's not forget the U.S. media, which has dutifully parroted the Venezuelan opposition's charges that Chavez is anti-democratic and unpopular. On August 15th, the Venezuelan people debunked this last charge decisively, giving Chavez nearly 60% of the vote in a failed recall referendum. Joining us now is Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a Knight Ridder columnist, and a Venezuela watcher. His latest column is titled, "Venezuela's Referendum Should Be a Wake-Up Call for the United States." Mark Weisbrot, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks, Steve.
Mark, U.S. pollster Stan Greenberg, who's well known as a Democratic pollster, who worked for the Venezuelan opposition, said last year, quote, "Hugo Chavez was once a polarizing figure. Now he's just unpopular," close quote. And Greenberg wasn't alone. Chavez opponents everywhere have said this same thing. To what would you attribute this underestimation of Hugo Chavez's support?
Well, first of all, that was an exaggeration even at the time. I mean, compared to other Latin American leaders, he was still pulling pretty good. I can't remember what he was referring to then. It was probably at least between 35 and 40%. And the reason he was so bad at that time was because the opposition had really destroyed the economy. It caused one of their worst recessions ever by their oil strike, which was devastating. You know, it's half the government's budget and three-quarters of their exports. So even though the strike was only participated in by less than 1% of the labor force, it was devastating. And you have this special thing in Venezuela where the media is controlled, 70-80% of the media is controlled by the opposition. So they were able to, and really controlled, I don't mean like Fox News might be sympathetic to the Republicans, but I mean something like, you know, Rush Limbaugh controlling all the broadcast and cable networks and the New York Times and the Washington Post and using it as a political tool every day to discredit the government. So what they were able to do is something you couldn't do in almost any other country in the world, which was to destroy the economy and then blame it on the president. And so that's where his popularity sunk. But, of course, as soon as the economy rebounded, and, of course, people learned increasingly every day not to believe what the Venezuelan media is saying, Chavez's popularity improved enormously. And he had another overwhelming victory. It's his third one in 3 years in terms of his own personal wins, third time he's been approved by a vast majority of the electorate. He had two other elections. And it's the eighth election that his government has won in 5.5 years.
On the issue of popularity, Venezuelan scholar Justin Delacour suggests in a recent Counterpunch that Chavez has never been as unpopular as hostile Venezuelan pollsters report. Until recent weeks, pollsters routinely reported Chavez's support in the 30% range mark, as you said before, but he got nearly double that in the referendum. Delacour suggests that part of Chavez's increased or apparent increased popularity is due to pollsters adjusting their results upward so as not to be embarrassed by the referendum's results. Do you think there's anything to that?
It's possible. It's hard to say. But I think it's possible that some of the previous results were exaggerated. And certainly they're spun. You know, they were all opposition polls until this election. And I think that's probably what changes that CITGO, which is owned by the government oil company, PDVSA, actually hired a reputable U.S. firm to do a poll before the election. And that poll was very good. It turned out to be exactly on target within its 2.5% margin of error. It showed Chavez winning right before the election. Between August 4th and 8th, the last poll was taken. And, of course, he was rising the whole time since June. Showed him ahead 50-38. And, of course, if you let the undecided split according to that split, it comes out almost exactly what happened. So that was, you know, it was very predictable in what would happen in this election. And, of course, the press kind of missed that. Most of the press reported that the election was too close to call. But it wasn't at all too close to call. It was very easy to call.
Well, there's another American media trope about Chavez's popularity. For instance, recently New York Times reporter Juan Ferrero described Venezuela's national oil company as awash in cash. And Ferrero called Chavez's use of those revenues, those oil revenues, to fund poverty programs a spending spree. Some might have read Ferrero as subtly hinting that Chavez may have bought votes, as many of his political opponents say. What do you say to that trope?
Well, Ferrero's accounts have actually been pretty good in terms of coverage of this referendum. There were other accounts that actually did call it vote buying. And I was on a lot of radio and TV shows where they referred to it as vote buying. And my response was simply, well, I wish George W. Bush would at least attempt to buy my vote by providing us with a national health care system. So there's definitely been a strong prejudice in the media towards looking at the provision of health care and education and literacy and microcredit and all the things that really caused people to really rally to Chavez in this referendum as somehow illegitimate.
Well, Mark, we've seen how some in the media have turned reality on its head regarding Chavez's popularity. But the most persistent media myth about Hugo Chavez, at least in the United States, is that he's an autocrat, anti-democratic, sometimes that he's called a communist, a Fidel Castro with oil. A Times editorial in June called Chavez an autocrat and questioned his devotion to democracy. The charges are familiar to U.S. media consumers, but they originated with Chavez's political opponents. Mark, what is the democratic reality in Venezuela?
Well, this is probably, Steve, I think the most Orwellian thing about this, and probably the most Orwellian reporting I can think of. I mean, you know, even in the Iraq War, all the things they told us, the justifications of the war turned out to be false. But Saddam Hussein was actually a dictator. And here we have a real democracy. I mean, it's as democratic and open a society as any in Latin America. And
it's hard to imagine a place where dissent is heard more loudly than Venezuela.
Yeah, you can get on TV and call for the overthrow of the government, something that you'd have trouble doing. You know, most places, people, in fact, who participate in the overthrow of the government, who would be in Guantanamo if they did this in the United States, are for the most part not bothered. There's probably more fear right here in the United States since September 11th, more intimidation of political activity, and more surveillance for sure here than there is in Venezuela. I mean, it's just not, there's no real evidence to back up any of these charges. If you look carefully at the websites of any of the human rights organizations, Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, you will never find anyone trying to say that political liberties or human rights deteriorated under the Chavez regime under the last 5.5 years. And what really makes it Orwellian is that the opposition is truly anti-democratic and led by anti-democratic people. They had a military coup where they abolished the Constitution, the Congress, and the Supreme Court. They tried to overthrow the government with the oil strike. And now look at them. They're actually went back on their commitment to honor the results of this referendum if it were certified by the Carter Center and the OAS, which it has been. And they're claiming massive fraud with absolutely no evidence. And so it's clear that they're trying to destabilize still, you know, the leadership at least, and the media owners, who are the most powerful element of the opposition, are trying to actually continue to destabilize the government. So this image of the authoritarian government is completely manufactured, and it is actually the opposite. The people who voted for Chavez are overwhelmingly pro-democracy, and they're voting, a lot of them, because they fear the opposition as an anti-democratic force that has proven to be such for the last 5.5 years.
We've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot, columnist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Mark Weisbrot, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
There's a saying that when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. That's certainly one reading of the ongoing tussle between broadcasters on the one hand and cable companies on the other over the country's transition to digital technology. As listeners know, the transition means, among other things, that each current broadcast channel is capable of carrying 6 channels. Remember how first that was going to mean super-duper high-definition TV, but then that fell somewhat by the wayside. However, it's ultimately used, digital technology means that these channels, for which current license holders paid exactly nothing, are worth hundreds of billions of dollars. But while the big guys try to decide how to share the riches among themselves, some are saying, wait a minute, set aside the specifics, there's something fundamentally wrong about the way these decisions are being made. We're joined now by telephone from Virginia by Jonathan Rintels, president of the Center for Creative Voices in Media and co-author of a recent column on the issue of digital technology and the public interest. Welcome to Counterspin, Jonathan Rintels.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk first about the big players, things as they are, which is the cable companies and the broadcasters. What is their current fight about, and what are their basic positions?
The broadcasters are wanting the cable operators to carry all of the digital channels that they will be broadcasting from their local affiliates. And right now, there's a rule that, in very simplistic terms, says you cable operators will carry the broadcaster's channel. Now, with digital technology, they'll be broadcasting up to 6 channels, and the broadcasters want them, the cable operators, to carry all 6. The cable operators really don't want to carry any of them, but only let the audience demand for each channel determine whether that channel will get on the cable system.
So the cable companies say, who already, by the way, provide most Americans with their television signal, they say, we don't want to have to carry these broadcasters' programs, but broadcasters want to make sure that all of their programming survives this transition to the new technology.
Exactly. The broadcasters say you must carry everything. The cable operators say we don't want to carry anything.
Well, where is the FCC in this discussion between broadcasters and cable companies?
Well, the FCC has said to these two opposing groups, Chairman Powell has said this repeatedly over the past year, could you please work this out privately or else we will have to act. They haven't taken a position one way or the other, and our position is, FCC, you can't take a position on what the public interest is on this until you actually determine whether broadcasters are operating in the public interest.
Well, it's an interesting role. Michael Powell often seems to be talking himself out of a job. Here's a man who's running a regulatory agency saying to the private companies, why don't you go off in a room and figure it out for yourselves? But there's also a fear here that current license and franchise holders are being made de facto owners of a resource that they're actually only borrowing, and borrowing supposedly with particular obligations. So let me bring you back to what you just started to say, which is you see this transition as really an opportunity to get back to the issue of public interest obligations, and maybe to give that kind of vague concept of public interest obligations some real flesh. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Our organization, the Center for Creative Voices and Media, is part of a coalition that includes groups like Common Cause and the Alliance for Better Campaigns. And we've put a proposal to the FCC to finally address the issue of what obligations a broadcaster who is using the public airwaves and has paid nothing for them owes to the public. It's a very modest proposal. It includes things like a minimum couple of hours a week of electoral or civic programming, programming that is not necessarily made by networks but is made by independent programmers, and a few other modest things. They're not even mandatory. They're actually best practices that will help a broadcaster get his license renewed faster. So it's a very modest proposal, but we think that before the FCC takes any action with regard to any of these issues, they finally have to sit down and say what the public interest is. And they've had a proceeding to do this open since 1999, and it's basically just been buried there. And we're saying unbury it. Let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's determine the public interest obligations of broadcasters, then determine whether they are indeed operating in the public interest and therefore entitled to have their broadcast signals on cable systems.
Well, Mark Cooper of the Consumer Federation of America gave some compelling testimony in a recent subcommittee hearing in which he said, you know, licensing is already in itself an intrusion on free speech rights of people, that there was a fear that a free-for-all would lead to interference that would drown out everybody's voice. So there was kind of a decision that a limited few would be permitted to speak over the airwaves in exchange for serving the public interest. His point was that technology now makes that compromise unnecessary, and ultimately he talks about setting aside at least half of the newly freed up spectrum for unlicensed users. So maybe rather than saying, okay, incumbent owners, you can have this tremendous windfall, but you know you ought to do some public interesty stuff in return, that in fact we ought to be thinking much, much bigger. What's your response to that? Do you see these minimal public interest obligations as opening the way for further demands that the public might make on media companies?
Well, as I say, our proposal is a very modest one, and I think Mark Cooper's proposal is a terrific one, and the technology may be there. The problem is that the horse is already out of the barn to a certain extent, that these broadcasters have been awarded the public spectrum for free in order to begin their digital broadcasting.
Well, I guess part of what we want to do is put forward some new models, since spectrum is itself not scarce. It's not like old growth forest, but what's scarce is government access to spectrum. So I guess you would agree that we're not really talking about technological questions so much as political questions, really. Well, some might say, finally, that we haven't heard as much as we might from the creatives, the artists, writers, producers on these media infrastructure issues, because they can't really criticize the industry that supports them. In light of that, why don't you tell us about the Center for Creative Voices in Media and how you fit in this conversation about reform?
Well, we organized for precisely that reason, that creative artists in media have not been well represented in the media policy debates, that most of our work is in television. When people think of television, they think of Hollywood, they think of Jack Valenti and NBC and Disney, but very often the interests of creative artists are very different from the interests of the industry, and never has that been more true than the ongoing battle over media consolidation and concentration, where the industry trumpets 500 channels, and we say, well, maybe 500 channels, but only five owners. In other words, as Senator Byron Dorgan said, many voices, few ventriloquists. We have a unique position in this fight because the public doesn't know what it's missing. We do know what they're missing. We know what they're missing in terms of the quality of programming. We know what they're missing in terms of important programming, not dumbed-down programming. We know what they're missing in terms of an independent, creative producer fighting for a vision as opposed to simply being an employee on the 13th rung of the organizational food chain at Disney or General Electric Company. And these are important differences. These are the difference between what could be great television and what can be totally mediocre television.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Rintels of the Center for Creative Voices in Media. His column on digital broadcasting and the public interest, written with Shelley Pingree of Common Cause, appeared in the August 11th Seattle Times. Thank you, Jonathan Rintels.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.